Hello, everybody. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio on the 2nd of July, 2020. And if you missed our shows yesterday, welcome to July. And here we are in the midst of a pandemic. All right, but I think we're all doing well, and I think we're all taking a breath right now trying to figure out what's going on for next year. And hopefully it's going to be a great year. We're going to do part two today of a conversation with Dr. Ashley Berner, who's the Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute on Education Policy. Excuse me, she's also an Associate Professor of Education at the Johns Hopkins School of Education. She's an amazing guest, and I'll explain how I know that in just a second. But in 2017, okay, she wrote a book. It's called Pluralism and the American Public Education. Pluralism and American Public Education, No One Way to School, okay? And that's N-O, No One Way to School. Okay, 2017 from Palgrave Macmillan, and you should check that out. Okay, Dr. Berner is really something. As you will learn if you check out our show, our part one of these two shows that we're doing, today's part two with Ashley, was Tuesday. And when you listen to this show, you'll see that there's a link there. And I'll connect it over to the first show we did on Tuesday. But Ashley's amazing. We're going to continue the conversation on school culture, school climate, based on, and we're going to talk about this new research based on a survey report that's out from Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy, and why you should be well aware of it, why you should get a copy, what it's in there, okay, because we'll be able to work on school culture, what it means to you, how it works, how it should work, why it matters, it does, and how to improve it, okay? And we'll give you all the information as we listen. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org. We'll tweet it out over at EduTalkRadio. Please go over to ace-ed.org, ace-ed.org. That is the home website of the American Consortium for Equity in Education, ace-ed.org. The newest issue of the official journal of the consortium, ACNE, Equity and Access, is there. Please just click through on the icon and enjoy a wonderful, wonderful online journal that we put together every other month. And there's a lot of great information over there. Our consortium is a place where everybody can meet and talk about what's going on with equity and access for all children. So please join our consortium, read our magazine. Everything we do over there at ace-ed.org is free for educators. So please go over and check it all out. All right, without further ado, let me bring on the one and only, now the two and only, because we have two shows, Ashley Rogers Berner. Okay, hello, Ashley. It's Larry. Welcome to the show again. Okay, and I was going to do, and here are some scenes from the first episode of the Ashley Berner Show. Oh my, school climate is an opportunity to claim a new model. It's based in civics. There you have Ashley's thoughts. Let's continue.
Thank you so much for having me back on. It's a real pleasure and a joy.
Well, I love the show so much. We got off on so many things the other day that we had to just continue talking. So we're doing it today, and I hope we'll do a lot more together. And I didn't do it yet, but I will put a link over at this show's description so everybody can go and listen to the other show, and I'll make that a vice versa thing. So with all the two shows are always connected. Okay, Dr. Berner, tell us. I just want to get into this. Okay. If they listen to the first show, they'll learn a lot about the democracy, the civics, et cetera, the foundations of school culture. And as we said, a lot of that somehow got lost. All right. We want to bring that back together again. We got some great examples, et cetera. And the new survey, there's new research based on the survey. Let's start with that today. Okay. From Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. Okay, talk about the new survey / research. Ashley.
Well, yes. So we spent a year looking at school culture surveys, not just in this country, but around the world. And we found some great models out there, but we also found some opportunities that areas that really weren't being investigated in our country that other countries look at, specifically things like an open classroom climate where distinctive different voices are heard and articulated and where students really learn how to disagree respectfully. So we have a lot of questions about that civics area of civic formation, which of course is really important. It's an important principle behind the funding of education in the first place. And the second area that's missing that is very, very important in the research, the body of research about what makes an effective school, is the notion of a shared mission and of a mission that is carried through in the practices of the school. And, you know, there really isn't a great national survey out there in our country that looks at this concept of mission alignment. And yet we know, and I'm happy to go into the research if you'd like, we know that's really critical. So we ask a lot of questions about that. But I just want to note that we also, based on our other research and things that those of us who work in education research know, there are other factors that are important too. So, for example, do you have a robust, challenging academic pathway for all kids? And do students feel challenged in the classroom? This is a very important issue for equity because the research from around the world shows that if you have a knowledge-based curriculum rather than a mere skills-based curriculum, that the learning gaps close. This is a really important equity point. So we also flag some of those things. And, for example, we've found in some of our early studies that sometimes there is a strong SES, socioeconomic status, racial, ethnic divide between which kids feel challenged and which don't. So that's another area. We also look at teacher culture and do teachers feel supported? Are teachers feeling that their principals are taking leadership with instruction? Do students see their principal in the hallways? What are those interactions like? We have an entire domain that we look at around the communality. Are we all in it together? And within that panel, we have lots of indicators such as, do students feel there are adults they can talk to in the building? It doesn't have to be a teacher, but adults who they can talk to about family issues, friendship issues, life plans, academic struggles. We give kids lots of opportunities to answer questions about that. That's actually important because the research, as we all know, shows that feeling known and seen is a really important indicator of student engagement and ultimately of student success. We also ask about, is there cheating going on? What is the sense of student behavior and what do students value in one another? So, the way we've designed the questions is to avoid the social desirability factor. We feel pretty confident that we've gotten very honest answers about this. So the research that we do and that we have looked at rolled into the design of this study, but it doesn't stop there. So one of the things we've created is an intervention guide that is research-based for our partners. So if you're in a school, you administer the survey, or you're a system leader for a charter network or Catholic school network or an entire district, and we've worked with all of the above, what do you do if you see some real areas of opportunity? What do you do if you see that certain groups of kids are not being challenged? What do you do if you find that principals are not perceived as engaged in the instruction?
Yeah.
So for every single one of those areas, we have created a kind of two-page document for each one that says, this is why these questions are important according to research. This is why it matters. Like, this is why you should care about this. And then here are some effective interventions that you can try as a school to help with this thing. Now, there are some areas where the research has not been conducted yet. So that's another area of research for us that as we partner with different systems, we want to be able to say, from year one to year two, what are you doing to address some of the things we've mm-hmm. seen and talked about? And then, in year two, do we see an impact? That then becomes something that we can report on and that will be helpful to the field, because it's all about helping every school get better.
It is about that. And you bring up, I have so many questions right off the bat, okay? But I'm going to start with this. First of all, in our current issue of our journal, which is over at ace-ed.org, everybody, go click on the journal icon. When the magazine opens, just go past the cover, and you'll see a huge ad, okay, for this survey. And that will tell you how to get in touch. But do you want to just say how to get in touch right now?
Absolutely. You can write me directly, which is ashley.burner, that's B-E-R-N-E-R, ashley.burner@jhu.edu. That's one way. The other way is that you just do a Google search for the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy, and on our homepage, there's a slider that links to the school culture survey. Those are the two easiest ways to get in touch, and that has my contact information as well. But I will.
Right, I'll put that on the description of the podcast. Can I ask you a question? This struck me when you said this. You know, I can't remember what I was watching, but this is not uncommon. And I'm going to use Detroit because that's whatever I was watching had this. In a school in Detroit, there was 3% of the kids. I saw this on TV yesterday. Maybe it was on the PBS NewsHour or something. Okay, 3% of the kids are reading to grade level. Okay, 3% of the kids. I guarantee you 98% of the kids will be promoted, all right? And
right.
It struck me, okay, about this and school culture. You know, obviously these kids, and these are not stupid kids. Let me make that point, okay? This does not fall on the kids, okay? There may be a few, but for the most part, these are normal kids. They just happen to be all black, okay? And
right.
Yeah, and my question is, it's a school culture thing, because we've been talked about this on Tuesday. We're talking about it today. There is a cultural connection that has been lost, okay, in education. We're talking about this, how there's so many different kinds of schools and areas in Switzerland, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But each school is directed to teach but use a cultural connections that makes sense to the people they're teaching, so
that's
that they
right.
learn better. They're related to the learning.
That's right.
An odd feeling that's not happening, and by the way, I'm using Detroit as the example because I just saw this one. I think I could aim almost any big city, okay? One size does not fit all for curriculum and culture.
Well,
and
I think that, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes.
Go ahead.
You've hit on something
you get
really,
my point.
You've hit on something really important. So, Two things for that, and then I want to give some examples. So, yes, most democracies do fund distinctive school cultures, and by that I mean schools that make normative claims about what they're doing and why. So most democracies don't just fund what we would call district schools. They do, but they also fund Jewish, Montessori, you know, socialist, secular college prep,
indigenous
all different
peoples.
Kinds
we
of
talked
schools.
About Alberta.
Yes.
Yeah, indigenous
right.
peoples.
I just,
yeah.
Right. Alberta, Canada funds First Nations, Inuit schools and so forth. These are really important because the connection between the community and the school is deeper than just location. It has to do with a common purpose. And in fact, many of these countries require and test on, not tests, that's the wrong word, but they require schools to make very clear what's different about them so that as parents and families decide, am I going to join this school community or not, they can make good decisions. So that's one key difference. But the academic build, and that's what you were touching on with Detroit, the academic build is different in kind from school culture. Yes, the cultural correlates are really important. You can't take a wonderful curriculum and slap it down on a school that is dysfunctional in its relationships and in its purpose. they do go hand in glove. Both of those go hand in glove. But when it comes to the culture around teaching and learning, which our survey does look at, it is noteworthy that American schools in general under-challenge students, and they under-challenge first-generation disadvantaged low SES kids first and foremost.
By the way, everybody, Ashley is a historian. Okay,
yeah,
she's
I'm
not
historian,
only
yes.
a professor of education, she has a degree in modern history. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have a master's
there,
in that
are,
too.
I have a doctorate in modern history. But there are
Oh you do?
Yeah,
you
I have a
doctorate.
I got my doctorate from Oxford University as a single mother, yeah.
Am I talking to J.K. Rowling? What's going on here? Single mother makes good.
Actually, when I went back to do my doctorate at Oxford, I had done a master's there. They were filming Harry Potter at Oxford, yes. But that's beyond the point. That's beside
Hogwarts.
The point. So I do. I
that's
do
besides
know,
the point. But I didn't know you had a doctorate in history. I knew you had a PhD, obviously, but I did not know it was in history. That makes me love you even more.
Well, I do love history. I do love it. But. So the question of – let me just give some examples of what this looks like before I talk about the why. So the opportunity myth, which is a report that TNTP produced last year, did show that in nationally representative samples that teachers – that low-income kids have only a 25% chance. I don't remember the exact statistics, but that statistically much less likely – like by a large factor, much less likely to be given on grade level challenging material than their wealthier peers. And this
Why?
Is a systemic
Why?
Problem. Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think it's a couple of things. I think there are some, first of all, historically, our teacher prep programs have walked away from a liberal arts model. And so we have not prepared teachers to deliver, to focus on content. We've prepared teachers to focus on disaggregated skills. And these came from deliberate decisions and debates that happened in the early 20th century. So by contrast, really high-performing systems democratized the liberal arts curriculum. They expected that in order to succeed, in order to create opportunity, every child, no matter what your background, needed access to the best possible learning content. And this is a whole area that's out that we work in a lot as an institute, but it's an equity issue again, that what happened in the early 20th century was, you know, prep school kids continued to have access to really rich content, but American kids in general were not given access to the very best literature. And this was intentional, and it was done with good intentions, but it ultimately redounded to expand the achievement gaps. So
What were the good intentions?
Well, I think there were folks, and this is what I actually studied at Oxford in my doctorate, is that teachers, as the teaching profession became professionalized, it had been the case up until the early 20th century that to become a teacher, in certainly in the Western nations, ours included, you had to pass extremely tough exit exams from high school that were content specific. You had to know your math, your science, your literature, your history cold. You had to know that content in and out. And then the teacher prep programs were all about deepening that content and teaching classroom management. So in the early 20th century, the teacher preparation became more focused on developmental psychology. And that was thought to be the key resource for teachers. And in fact, it continues today. There's nothing wrong with developmental psychology. It's really, really important for teachers to understand, things, many other subjects that they study that are not specifically content based, but that's where the big divide happened. Most English speaking countries decided that it was about developmental psychology, and B, this is the other piece of it, that content was irrelevant, that skills, or put differently, learning how to learn, the process, was more important than the content. And then you even had some voices in the early 20th century that would argue that it was oppressive to require students to learn anything in particular. So now we have generations of Americans, including our teachers, who themselves were not bequeathed this rich tradition. Or, and I should say, I'm not just talking about Western civ. There are fantastic resources that are multicultural, that are strong, and that's where we should be going. It should be a both and. So our country is somewhat unique in that.
Wow.
In that A, and this is about the academic build first and foremost. So all successful educational systems have a clear content that's required. And our English-speaking peers, namely the UK and most provinces of Canada, that also departed from a clear content. Most of them have returned to it. Alberta, Canada, in the 1970s, was so bereft of content that there were only two courses required for graduation from high school. And there were no rigorous content-based assessments. And by the way, even they did have to take Canadian history and social studies, but even those courses, when you look under the hood, they were not about what happened and why and where countries were. It was a sort of psychological inquiry about why people acted as they did. So Alberta went through a remarkable change in the 1970s and 80s in which it actually put in place a robust curriculum and assessments that matched it, and it expanded its school choice, for want of a better word. It had already funded Catholic and Protestant schools, but it expanded to even homeschoolers. And they also redistributed property funding so that it was an equity bid, but it catapulted Alberta to the top of the list of high performing school systems. So the United States is just getting back to the program here. And the reason I want to mention this is because Detroit has a superintendent who understands it's Superintendent Vitti, who understands why knowledge is important. And when he was the superintendent in Duval County, Jacksonville, and our institute's written about this, he put in place some of the best, strongest, most challenging curricula. I think he used Engage New York, which was a core knowledge. It had in ELA, it had core knowledge. In math, it had Eureka Math. And they spent years norming their systems and their teachers on delivering this really high-quality content that is knowledge-based. And Duval County, its test scores improved by a lot. I mean, by an order of magnitude. So now six other districts in Florida are copying them. So when Vitti went to Detroit, he took his time getting to know the system and deliberating about knowledge-based curriculum. And I know that in ELA, they put expeditionary learning, or EL, in there. And, you know, EL is a content-rich curriculum. And I would bet money that schools like the one that you were talking about are going to be getting better. It takes a lot of work at the school level.
It does, and a lot of time.
It takes time. It takes really supporting teachers. By the way, Baltimore City, where I live, is one is another very, very underperforming school districts, where you've got in schools where only 5% of the kids can read. And Dr. Santalisi, the superintendent, did the same thing. She has put in place Wit and Wisdom, which is one of the best knowledge-rich ELA curricula, and Eureka Math. And they have dedicated 10 days of professional development a year to it. And but this is why we were talking about under-challenging kids. She walks her classrooms. She walks her schools and helping and encouraging teachers to not spoon feed kids, because they have to have the productive struggle. They have to be able to wrestle something to the ground. And the habits of our teachers are such that they think it's helpful to kids to kind of prompt and feed, but students need to take ownership of their learning. And that means they have to be challenged. That means they have to be given low grades when they're not doing well. We have to start saying the truth to our kids about what they're really capable of. And this, by the way, is something that we do look at with a school culture survey. So
that's important.
When there is a problem with, you know, when we work with a system and there are schools where a certain percentage of kids are challenged and a certain percentage are not, there's a very clear pathway that the leader can take. You can put in place the best possible, most challenging, rigorous material and expect your kids to achieve it. But of course, it's not that simple. There are all kinds of strategies that you have to do to deliver on grade level learning while also remediating the back, you know, what has not been taught along the way. But it's really important not to lose track of the grade level learning.
And I love everything you're saying. And what effect? And this is important. When the kids are challenged with good content, and let's just stay with Detroit. Why not? Okay, and Dr. Vitti. All right. When the kids are challenged, I have this feeling that they start to get a sense that they're being respected. Okay,
yes,
if
absolutely.
I could just put it that way. Okay.
Absolutely.
And thank you for agreeing with that. That instead of being spoon-fed crapola, okay, they're actually being challenged, and hopefully they're being challenged in a cultural way that they can understand it, all right? And what I think you're saying is that when that happens, the mindset of the entire school changes, okay?
Well, that's right.
Yeah, go ahead.
And the very process of delivering rich content that is actually challenging and, frankly, that teachers need to prep for in a whole new
way. Yeah,
that
exactly.
actually boosts student engagement. And that's one of the things we're expecting to see year on year as with the school culture survey is student engagement growing? Are student absentees, is the absentee rate dropping? And because you're doing something interesting and intelligent, and even and here's the other thing: really good curricula and schools that really emphasize instruction should be sending home notes to parents saying things like, "Your child learned about the Roman Empire today. Ask them questions about blah, blah, blah." That gives kids a chance to be experts in their own home. And by the way, there's a really interesting sort of known fact that first-generation immigrant families and urban families want their kids to be more challenged. It tends to be the kind of suburban families that think their kids are doing better than they are. And the studies, Harvard has done some studies that look at the international assessments from the standpoint of socioeconomic status, and at every level, at every income level, highest all the way to lowest, our kids underperform their matched peers in the same income bracket. So as far as I'm concerned, there is not an American who can feel great about what our kids are learning at this point.
I unfortunately would agree. I would probably agree with you on that.
Here's the hope for this.
Well, wait, I'm going to ask you something. We're talking about the kid. I just have to ask you this. So I just want to stay on this for a second. You talked about it improves, and I believe this 100% student engagement. Okay. I am hoping, and I think I'm right, because teachers, like anyone else, can get lazy in their jobs. I hope it's not your neurosurgeon or your air traffic controller that I'm talking about here. But people can get lazy in their jobs. This is not an indictment of teachers. I'll use myself. Everybody gets lazy. But when you're suddenly asked by a good leader, okay, to do more, my question is, are the teachers stepping up to this the way they should? That's part of school
absolutely.
Culture.
Absolutely. One of the interesting things, so our institute works a lot with Baltimore City, and when they decided to put Wit and Wisdom in place and they started the professional development process, the teachers did not believe that the kids could do it. And they were massively discouraged, and not massively, but there were teachers who just thought, our kids can't do it. And the professional development teams said, yes, they can, just give it a chance. So it really requires teacher behaviors to shift and teacher expectations to shift. But this is something that actually fulfills why teachers went into the profession in the first place.
Exactly.
I would hazard a guess.
And we lose track of that.
Yeah. I would hazard a guess that if you went into your average Detroit or Baltimore public school and went around with a micro, you know, with a recorder saying, why did you go into this field? You know, most teachers are going to say, because I love children and I want them to succeed. And so giving teachers the tools that they need and the support that they need is everything. And so I would say it's a win for teachers when they're given, by the way, most teachers spend 6-8 hours a week selecting materials from the internet, and they are, you know, delighted when they're given something that's strong and complete.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I want to ask you a question, okay? How old? I know the survey and research are new. How new are they?
Well, the research, it depends on which area. So the research on civics and what the early indicators of civic formation are, that's been robust and stable for 40 years. The research on why school culture is important actually came out of an interesting context. You may have talked about the Coleman Report on your show. James Coleman was hired by the federal government to study the effects of the integration and on schools. And this was in 1965. And he studied, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids, teachers, schools across the United States. And his report on equity, now it's kind of shortened as the Coleman Report in 1966, that came out. That was the first time that anyone had systematically studied the outcomes of education. It was all up until that point about inputs. How many books do they have? What degrees do their teachers have? Okay, so he studied the outcomes, and the highest level finding that he presented was, in general, American education does not change the trajectory for kids. What you're given in your family background dictates where you finish. Now, that's in the aggregate in gross terms. It was a devastating report, and
that
it was a really important report. But let me say what Coleman also found. He also noticed that there were schools that did break that mold. And so he spent, you know, years and years studying high schools. And the book that he published in, oh gosh, I think it was 1982, was actually the first book that in our country talked about the Catholic school effect. Because what he found was that Catholic schools, Catholic high schools in particular, in that era, closed the achievement gap between wealthy and poor kids in 4 years' time. It was this famous Catholic school effect. In fact, his book actually says Catholic high schools are the common school that we always wanted. And I've never read a sociologist write in such strong terms. But then his protege, Tony Bright, who works on creating effective schools, studied Catholic schools for a long time. And he wrote a book called Catholic Schools and the Common Good about the factors that made this possible. One strong one was school culture and all the social capital building that occurs. The other was the narrow liberal arts curriculum. So why do we care about this as researchers? We care not just because we think Catholic schools are an important part of the landscape, but because what can we learn from that every school can implement?
Exactly.
And that is actually why we have everything that we do as a research team at Johns Hopkins Institute is we focus on the levers that any school can pull. Any school can improve its school culture. Any school can put in place a really challenging curriculum.
And let me say I got to say this. Any school can do that. And an administrator or principal, whatever, may think they can do it because they have the good intentions. But you can't do it. And I say this without hesitation throughout education, without research. Okay.
Well, you need the research to back it up, and you also need time.
You're not out there flailing in the ocean.
Let's put it this way. There's no need to reinvent the wheel.
Thank you. And education
research doesn't travel very effectively. That's one of the stunning things. So one of my favorite research studies came from Chicago, with Chicago Public Schools put, and this is apropos to our work here, our conversation here. Chicago Public Schools put international baccalaureate into 16 or 17 of their low-performing high schools.
Nobody
thought that the kids were up to it, but they insisted on it.
Here we go again.
And there was a full, exactly. And the kids who went through all 4 years of the pre-IB diploma program and the IB diploma program had a 40% greater chance of going to college than their match peers. And so Rahm Emanuel made IB a signature platform of his tenure as mayor because they have mayoral control. And so that does circle back to our point earlier that kids need to be challenged and they thrive. I want to close with one thing I just saw recently. So if you're familiar with Bard College. Bard College is a liberal arts institution run by Leon Botstein in New York State.
They're liberal arts
all the way. Well, they've created two models to support all different populations. They have the Bard Early College High School that it kids end up graduating high school with 2 years of community college, but it's liberal arts. It is challenging, rigorous, real stuff taught by college professors. And they also have the Bard Prison Initiative. And if you want to see something that will break your heart and give you hope at the same time, if you look at the public television has a series called Prison Behind Bars, and it is all about prisoners having access to Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, Shakespeare. This is what we're meant for, is engagement with really important questions.
And so, you know, and this is all of this, and I know we're all trying to improve it and all that, but it's such a sad commentary on what we've been doing wrong, and we've got to change this, because once you change the school culture, you change schools, you change education, okay? And we've got to be on top of this, and we've got about 3 minutes left. Here comes the question. And I want everybody, again, it's the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. You can get Ashley at ashley.berner, B-E-R-N-E-R, at J-H-U-E-D-U. I'll put all this up when you listen to the show if you want to share this with people. Real quick, if you can do it. If not, we'll do another show, Ashley, and we can do it. I want to talk about COVID. Can there be school culture during COVID?
We've designed a remote learning version. Because our instinct is that, our guess is that schools will be in and out of face-to-face in the next 18 months. And it still matters that kids feel connected. It still matters that students are being given rigorous learning opportunities. It still matters that all parents, including maybe especially first-generation parents, feel included.
Yep.
And that teachers are given the support they need. So we already have plans to put this in the field in the fall, whether schools are operating face-to-face or remote.
Some might be. I heard yesterday that in places, I'll use Wyoming and Montana, where there's not that much COVID, schools will have a better chance of face-to-face than in a place like New York or Baltimore or Boston or whatever the case may be. And so it's not going to be, again, as I said, it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all anymore. We're going to do more together, Dr. Berner.
I think July 22nd we have another radio show,
welcome
correct?
Welcome back. Okay,
I look
that's
forward
perfect.
To it.
Yeah, I love having you on. In fact, I have to tell you something that's very funny. I have next to me my legal pad, and I'm doing something I wish I was in your class because I actually took notes.
That's funny. Well, if you want to look at if you want a crash course in the structure of education course, I did a TEDx talk on educational pluralism that you can check out. It's a 14-minute foray into our cultural expectations around education and why we have them.
I will look that up. It's a TEDx with Ashley Berner, B-E-R-N-A-R. Yep. I'm writing down, TEDx.
It's B-E-R-N-E-R.
Berner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not B-U-R, B-E-R-N-E-R.
Right.
Okay. Ashley, you're wonderful, incredible. Have a good 4th of July. In other words, don't do anything. Okay.
Yeah,
that's what both turned out to
be.
Yeah. Yeah, don't do anything. Just stay in your basement and cuddle around a blanket and everything will be fine. Okay? And I will talk to you soon. Okay? So thank you, Dr. Berner. You're wonderful. Bye-bye. Okay. That is Ashley left. I didn't realize she left already. Okay. Ashley Berner, Dr. Berner, she's great. I love having this woman on the show. She's just amazing. Ashley.Berner@jhue.edu. And also, this is the easier way. Google Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. It's their big school culture survey and research. And again, it's the first two pages. Once you open our cover at ace-ed.org of our magazine or online journal, you'll see a big, big explanation of all this. This is great stuff. We'll archive the show at education-talkradio.org. Tweet it out at EduTalk Radio, and please go over to ace-ed.org. Join our consortium. Everything we do is free. It's all about equity. I'm Larry Jacobs. Thanks for listening.